not once.
To be perfectly frank, we've begun wondering how you've managed a profit margin on such a sustainable basis.
You make that sound like it's a bad thing.
Of course not.
Something sharpened in the moon's gaze.
But wouldn't you agree that if something seems too good to be true, it probably is?
Too good to be true? Siddiqui cocked an eyebrow. Well, in that case, take a look.
The lift had stopped completely. As the doors opened, she gestured for him to step out onto the open scaffolding and couldn't help feeling a twinge of amusement as Slipher's eyes widened slightly, losing their veneer of detachment. Below them, a herd of inmates burst into the gallery, snarling and jeering, shoving one another aside, feet clanging on the steel gallery floor as they formed an open circle. In the middle of the circle, someone was screaming.
Ah, Siddiqui said, the morning festivities have already begun.
Directly underneath them, 30 yards down, three inmates, all of them human, with shaved heads and thick beards, were holding a fourth prisoner and beating him savagely with what looked like long shafts of sharpened bone. When the victim fell to his knees, one of his assailants hoisted him back up again, while another plunged the sharpened bone spear directly into his chest, shoving it through so far that it burst out between the inmate's shoulder blades in a spray of blood and shattered vertebrae.
Oh,
the moon said thickly.
What?
Bone kings, Siddiqui said.
Along with the Gravity Massive, they're one of the biggest gangs in the Hive.
She shrugged.
Every so often, tensions boil over.
The moon considered this for a moment.
How can there be any allegiance within the gangs when one member might be matched against another at any given moment?
We screen for that,
Siddiqui said. The algorithm factors in sociological variants as well as physical ones.
Actually, we've discussed the idea of pitting entire crews against one another.
Really?
Oh, yes.
The prospect of a crew-on-crew tag-team brawl, for example, between certain members of the Kings and the Gravity Massive, could be something that the gambling community has never seen before.
It's already generated significant interest with some of the odds makers.
I can see why,
the moon said. He had to raise his voice to be heard. Down below, the impaled prisoner was somehow shrieking louder. His gurgling cries only brought laughter from the crowd, whose response in turn seemed to encourage the three kings to greater frenzies of violence. Howling, they yanked their weapons loose and stabbed their victim again until he collapsed, sagging forward, his broken frame dangling on the end of the makeshift spear like a twisted puppet. A great cheer went up from the mob of prisoners, and then, as suddenly as it had begun, the assault was over, the other inmates drifting away, leaving the three Bone Kings to bend over the mangled corpse of their victim.
Now, what are they doing?
Slipher managed.
Deboning.
The moon swallowed audibly.
I beg your pardon.
They ripped the bones out,
Siddiqui told him. Sharpened them on the walls, carry them around in their sleeves, that sort of thing.
And you permit that as well?
Siddiqui shrugged.
Every standard week or so, the guards will search the cells and confiscate whatever they find.
I see.
The moon nodded.
I suppose it's all great theater.
Oh, no, Siddiqui said. It's not theater at all.
That's one of the reasons that gamblers can't seem to get enough of what we do here.
Face it, Mr. Slipher.
In a galaxy where so much has become virtual or simulated, what we offer is as real as it gets. We've actually discussed the possibility of offering VIP packages to high rollers, so that they could come and watch the fights in person.
Here? To the prison itself?
We've had real interest from communities as far away as Coruscant.
Well, the moon was nonplussed. It seems that you're just a font of brilliant ideas, Warden.
Not just me. Siddiqui nodded modestly. Although I do like to think of this place as a crucible from which true superiority emerges, and everyone profits. The Ratataki people have a particular memorable way of putting it. Chimoto Mando Sangui.
Meaning?
The whole thing runs on blood.
A provocative sentiment, the moon said, looking down again as the three inmates turned and fled with an armload of bloody bones, leaving the shapeless, scooped-out mass on the steel floor behind them. They're amazingly fast, aren't they?
The moon shuddered.
Although the catwalk where they were standing was enclosed in a thick layer of protective transparasteel, the overpowering smell of spilled blood, dirty fabric, and airborne bacteria hung permanently in the space around them.
A little bit different from the Sabacc parlors on Lamored, isn't it? She said.
A new possibility seemed to have occurred to Slipher.
Can any of the inmates see us up here?
Siddiqui shook her head. Not from this angle.
We have guards stationed at various posts around the upper scaffolding, and cameras down below.
And you just allow them to wander freely like that?
Free is hardly the word, Siddiqui said, and checked the chrono display on her tablet. They're always watching each other. And we're always watching them.
So you've never had an escape?
She cocked an eyebrow at him. I thought we were discussing profit margins, Mr. Slipher.
It's a valid question. These inmates of yours have nothing to do all day but study their surroundings and isolate any vulnerabilities in your security systems.
We've implanted every inmate with...
I'm aware of the procedure, the moon said dryly. Still, it occurs to me...
His voice trailed off.
Never mind.
What?
Well, you've given me an admirable demonstration of why your operation here continues to generate such fervent interest among gamblers and blood sport aficionados. But that's only part of it, isn't it?
I'm not sure that I follow.
Oh, I think you do.
His fingers knit themselves inward, pressing against his chest in thought.
In order for Coghive 7 to make the astronomical profit that it reports to my board of directors, you have to predict the winner of the bouts almost 100% of the time.
He turned to her.
I don't suppose you'd be interested in telling the IBC how exactly you do that?
Siddiqui glanced back at the lift. Come with me, she said.
Seven. Gravity massive.
Maul watched the mess hall clearing out. After the other inmates left, he had remained standing against the wall, observing the guards along the upper perimeter as they went about their patrols. He marked their passage along with the servo droids that circulated in and out of the hall along with the other inmates. At first, nothing seemed to have changed. In the glare of the overhead lights, he watched how the guards and the droids and the inmates all interacted, how they moved among one another, observing their patterns. There were places that they moved and stood and waited, and there were gaps, openings in the gallery that led back to the cells, vacancies where no light fell.
He has been known to visit ventilation conduit 11AZR.
It smelled like a setup, pure and simple. Yet it might also be the opportunity that he'd been waiting for. Remembering what Coyle had said, Maul felt a sharp wedge of tension pressing low and tight beneath his sternum. A sense of urgency to go forward and assert himself among those who would try to cut him down, to betray him and undermine his mission here. It was what his master would have wanted.
"You'll go in as a criminal,"
Sidious had told him,
"and live among those animals, within the confines of your new identity of a mercenary and assassin, relying only on your own wit and cunning, not only for the purposes of the mission, but for your very survival. You must assume that every inmate will be looking for an opportunity to stab you in the back at any moment."
Straightening up, Maul took one more look at the mess hall until he found what he was looking for. In his mind, an idea had already begun to take shape. It was primitive, but it would work. Off to his left, a crew of inmates that Coyle had identified as the Gravity Massive, perhaps 6 or 7 in total, headed up by their Nogri and his Nelvanian sidekick, had continued to loiter near the exit, all staring at him intensely. Maul stepped directly toward them. Drawing nearer, he saw all their exposed right arms beginning to tense and flex together, like the individual muscle fibers on a single organism. None of them took a step back.
"Are you Strabo?"
Maul asked. The Nogri didn't flinch.
"Who's asking?"
"The Bone Kings."
Maul glanced back at the other gang on the opposite side of the mess hall.
"They want a meeting."
The inmate's eyes narrowed.
"What?"
"That scum over there."
Maul turned and shot a glance across the mess hall to where the Bone Kings were standing on their side, glaring at him more intensely than ever.
"They told me to give you the message."
"What kind of meeting?"
"I don't know," Maul said. "And I don't care."
He locked the Nogri in his glare, defying him to look away.
"They said it's happening in Ventilation Conduit 11AZR.
Turning, he walked away, not bothering to look back. By the time he got to the exit, an inmate from the Bone King's crew, the bearded human that Coyle had identified as Nailhead, was blocking his way. The man was a monster in human form, scars rippling across his forehead, with a sharpened fragment of bone rammed through his nose. There was dried blood in his beard, and his teeth were crooked yellow pegs set at uneven intervals in his mouth.
"Hey, Puke,"
he said. Maul stared at him.
"I'm Vasco Nailhead. I run the Bone Kings."
The man allowed a grin to flash across his face.
"Suppose you tell me what you were saying to the Gravity Massive about us back there."
"Ask them yourself,"
Maul said. He started to take a step, and the man's hand stopped him.
"I'm asking you."
The man leaned in close enough that Maul could smell the blood in his beard. His breath reeked like an open grave. From the cuff of his short sleeve, something sharp and yellowish-gray gleamed, just barely visible at throat level, ready to slash.
"Now I'm gonna ask again. Real nice. What did you say? Was it about what we'd done to them this morning?"
"They want a meeting," Maul said.
"Is that right?"
Nailhead licked his lips.
"And just whereabouts did they say this little rendezvous was supposed to take place?"
"Ventilation Conduit 11AZR.
Maul leaned in close.
Oh, they told me one more thing.
What's that?
They said, get ready to bleed.
Eight. Mute Math. The turbo lift opened onto absolute silence. Stepping out, Siddiqui led Vesto Slipher across the data center, full of blinking consoles and cabinets of server racks, whose sweeping ergonomic curvature filled the entire width of the viewport, overlooking the prison's central docking station. The entire room around them seemed to be holding its breath. Off to her right, Slipher opened his mouth to speak, and then stopped, puzzled, when no sound came out. Siddiqui tilted her chin up, indicating the cross-hatched wedges of acoustical foam running perpendicular to one another, lining the walls and ceiling, absorbing every decibel of ambient noise. The moon nodded in understanding. For a moment they just stood there, watching the young man at the console going about his work, streaming the previous night's data flow, running diagnostics, making all the fine adjustments that constituted the fabric of his existence here. At last, Siddiqui tapped a switch, and the foam wedges changed angulation ever so slightly, the eerie silence draining away as the data center filled with the buzz and rumble of ambient sound. At once, the whole room seemed to exhale around them with an audible sigh of relief.
Very impressive, Slipher said when his voice returned. White noise generators, I presume?
Not entirely. Siddiqui nodded. There's a design component as well. The whole data center is an anechoic chamber.
A soundproofed room?
Both inside and out, she said. Do you know anything about tapered impedance?
I'm afraid it's rather outside my field.
Siddiqui nodded at the walls. Those foam wedges alternate at 90 degrees out of phase with each other. When they're properly aligned, the pyramidical absorbers simulate a continuous change in the dielectric constant. She shook her head. It's all been designed to create what my brother calls an absolute free-field open space of infinite dimension. It literally swallows sound waves.
Your brother?
The moon glanced at the young man, seated in front of the command suite.
He sounds highly intelligent.
He is. She shuddered. Personally, I find it all incredibly creepy.
Ah.
The moon gave his smirk again.
You prefer noise.
Siddiqui shrugged. I prefer reality.
In that, we find ourselves in agreement.
Still, the moon regarded the room with new respect.
You know, for a moment, I couldn't even hear my own heartbeat.
I've never quite gotten used to it. Of course, I'm not the reason it's been installed here. Walking over to the young man in the gray tunic, Siddiqui leaned down to brush her lips against his cheek. Sleep all right? He turned and glanced up at her, an abstracted, childlike smile rising over his face. This silent twin, her own personal ghost, as if she'd only just now wakened him from a pleasant dream. Knowing that the smile wasn't for her didn't make it any less endearing. Siddiqui understood that her brother's first and truest gratification in life had always come from his algorithm. May I introduce my brother Dakarai? Siddiqui said. Dakarai, this is Vesto Slipher from the IBC. He's come to check up on us and make sure we're not dipping into the till.
Oh, now really, Slipher said. I'd hardly phrase it that way.
He ventured nearer, approaching the cabinets of data storage and processing units.
So this is the famous Dakarai Blur. I have heard so much about you, from many trusted sources.
He extended his hand.
The pleasure's all mine.
Dakari just gazed at the hand, his expression inscrutable, then turned instead and reached for the white ceramic coffee cup with the stylized CH7 logo emblazoned on the side. "You'll have to excuse my brother." Siddiqui watched as he lifted the cup with both hands like a child, bringing it up to his lips. "He hasn't spoken aloud to anyone in 10 years.
"Really?"
the moon asked.
"Not even you?"
"Not a word, I'm afraid," Siddiqui said, gazing down at her brother with what might have been a hint of melancholy. Real or artificial, even she wasn't sure. At this point, I don't think I would even recognize the sound of his voice. Dakari looked back up at her. Above the rim of the coffee cup, his programmer's eyes shimmered, pale blue and slightly watery, lit from deep within. In the ambient monitor glow, Siddiqui sometimes thought their irises appeared almost liquid crystal gray, like beads of condensation, deeply set in the smooth, pale face, whose high forehead and patrician nose were so strikingly an evocation of her own. Like her, he wore his jet-black hair just slightly shaggy, the chopped bangs tumbling over the brow in an errant simulation of serrated recklessness.
"Not a word in 10 years.
The moon reflected, looking back at Dakari as if seeing him in an entirely different light.
"Is it a vow of some sort?"
"Nothing so monastic, I don't think," Siddiqui said, running her fingers fondly through her brother's hair. "Dakari is a connoisseur of soundlessness. The last time we spoke, he told me that he found the silence of the algorithmic certainty to be the closest thing to pure joy that he ever heard. Everything else, including his own voice, is just a distraction."
"I see."
"Math is music," he told me once. "And it's perfect. So why should we think that we can somehow improve on it with our grunts and howls?"
"Math is music."
The moon reflected, visibly pleased with the phrase.
"Again, we find ourselves uncannily like-minded. And speaking of mathematics,"
he turned back to the consoles,
"I assume that this is where you run the software? The systems that arrange all the fights, correct?"
"That's right," Siddiqui said. "Dakari wrote all the code himself. After he finished upgrading the Ando Overland pod racing course for the Decilogy clan 5 years ago, he got the idea to create a completely new piece of software." Seeing Dakari wince at her choice of words, she corrected herself.
"Excuse me, an algorithm that could analyze all the data from every potential contestant in a closed gladiatorial environment to create the closest and most exciting competitions in the history of galactic pit fighting."
"So," the moon said, leaning in, "from this suite, you can monitor
every aspect of every inmate's behavior," she said.
"Yes, that's correct. Everything from weight gain to heart rate to the constantly changing alliances among prisoners and gang allegiances that might factor into the outcome of a bout. The algorithm analyzes all of it and generates 2 sets of inmate numbers for 2 matches every day."
"2?
"We're considering adding a third." Siddiqui's eyes flicked back to the monitor screens again, scanning them more carefully. "Anything new to report?" Dakari paused, steepled his fingertips on either side of the bridge of his nose, and shook his head. Frowning a little, he tapped in another series of commands, waiting while the data washed up over the screen, and then squinted at what he saw there.
"What is it?"
she asked him. When Dakari's frown didn't change, Vesto Slipher leaned in, glancing at one of the monitor screens on the far right of the console, where a Zabrak inmate with an array of horns on his head was moving away from the crowd in the gallery, cutting down one of the concourses into the shadows.
"If I'm not mistaken," the moon said, "that's your new champion,
is it not?
He did win last night, yes.
Quite spectacularly, if I recall.
Slipher turned to Siddiqui. Where is he going?
Wherever it is, Siddiqui said, checking her chrono and the most recent data that had just come streaming across to Karai's inflow monitor. He won't be there long.
Why not?
She cast him a wry half-grin.
You're about to find out.
Nine. Strap hanger.
Cutting sideways along the well-lit expanse of the prison's central gallery, Maul glanced up at the ventilation shafts that ran overhead, each one stenciled with call signs and architectural designations. A series of worn letters were fairly visible overhead. VC09AMA. He kept walking, fingertips tracing the beads of condensation from the walls, feeling it growing colder to the touch. The ceiling was sloping downward, the walls closing in as he made his way forward. Air filtration systems, atmospheric reprocessing units with fans the size of starship turbines, roared out their incessant threnody overhead. But the noise wasn't enough to block out the sound of the prison's gallery behind him. In between slabs of machinery, black lenses gleamed, following his every step. When the walkway ended in a T, he turned right, passed by the first corridor, and checked the shaft above him. VC-11-AAR. Closer, then. The big fans had gone quieter, and now Maul could hear his own footsteps echoing down the passageway. He stopped and sniffed the air, smelling stale water and engine lubricant. The cameras could still be watching him here, of course. That didn't matter. If the prison administrative staff wanted to stop him, they could have shut down the concourse in front of him at any time. He moved on, checking the ventilation markings every few meters now. When he reached 11AZR, the walkway intersected with another passage. Maul stopped, turned right, and took three steps until he came across a series of curved steel rungs bolted into the wall leading up to a maintenance hatch. He froze. Behind him, in the direction from which he'd come, something was coming, making a steady pounding noise. Maul held his breath and listened. It sounded like wings. Glancing up, he saw it coming, a black shape flying straight at him down the passageway. He ducked just in time, and it brushed past his face close enough that he felt the oily, musky-smelling slickness of its black feathers against his cheek. Pivoting in midair, the thing flapped its wings, settling itself on an electrical conduit, staring down at him with black and curious eyes. Maul looked up at it. It was a clawbird, almost a half-meter high, small for its breed. Maul had seen hollows of them hunting womp rats on Wayland, with claws like vibroblades and a serrated beak that could rip through flesh like butter. But what was a mutated avian species from an outer rim planet doing in a prison? Still staring at him, the clawbird opened its mouth and emitted a harsh, scolding caw. It sounded like laughter. The cry rattled down the length of the corridor. Maul scowled at the thing. It was making too much noise, and he couldn't hear anything else over the din.
Get out of here, Maul told it. Go!
The bird stayed and croaked louder than ever, as if determined to betray Maul's location to anyone in the area. Bending down, he found a loose metal bolt on the floor and pitched it at the bird, sending it upward with a startled croak. It flew away down the passage. In the silence, Maul cocked his head, listening again. Now he could make out what he'd come to hear. Footsteps. Rapid but not panicked, coming faster now,
big by the sound of it, but not clumsy or uncertain. Boots. Authoritative. Maul climbed up the steel rungs toward the ceiling of the shaft. Bracing his feet against an overhanging electrical switchplate, he gripped the edge of the maintenance hatch and drew himself up until he disappeared into the shadows. He kept his body absolutely rigid, every muscle locked in place, staring straight down at the intersection of the two passageways below. Directly below him, a figure emerged into view. The faint glow of equipment illuminated the helmet and face shield, the heavy broadcloth fabric of his uniform rustling as he approached. A guard. Maul found himself staring down at the top of the corrections officer's helmet. From here it was impossible to see his face. Not that it mattered.
"I know you're out there,"
the CO said, looking from side to side. His hand was resting on his belt, not on the blaster, but on something else. A flat black console of the dropbox strapped to his hip, with a green glowing display that Maul couldn't read from this angle.
"Why are you looking for Zero?"
Maul gripped the hatch in front of him more tightly, allowing himself one deep breath. A drop of moisture, ice-cold and oily, fell from one of the overhead condenser units. It struck the top of his head, rolled down between his horns and off his scalp, and slithered down the side of his face to his chin.
"Zero already knows you're different,"
the CO was saying.
"Heard you're an assassin. Saw you fight. You're not here by accident."
Maul held absolutely still.
"The way he sees it, there's only one reason that somebody like you would come out to the far corner of the galaxy and start asking for him."
The guard continued.
"You came here to kill him. Am I right?"
Maul waited. The CO had stopped looking from side to side now. His eyes were riveted to something straight ahead of him. The droplet fell from Maul's chin and hit the guard's helmet with a soft but audible plop. The CO stiffened, tilted back his head, and looked straight up at Maul, the whites of his eyes reflecting yellowish red in the light spill.
"I thought so," he said. "You know what? I don't even need this blaster to take care of you."
He indicated the dropbox strapped to his belt.
"I got your numbers plugged in already, maggot. I touch this button, set off those bombs inside your chest. You're dead before you hit the floor."
"Where's Zero?"
Maul asked.
"You're kidding, right?"
His fingers flickered over the switches of the belt console, and Maul was almost positive that he hadn't yet heard the noises at the far end of the walkway. Whispers and footsteps that had become steadily more audible over the past few seconds.
"You actually think he'd let you get the drop on him like this?"
Now the CEO's entire demeanor had changed, developing an edge, losing whatever playfulness it might have had.
"You never had a chance."
"I don't think so,"
Maul said. The distant sounds were clearer now, the whispering no longer bothering to keep itself stealthy, the footsteps no longer muffled. Maul watched as the CEO started to react, the man caught completely by surprise by what was happening, but it was already too late. A storm of stomping feet came thundering down through the passage, an avalanche of noise clanging off the metal and shaking the length of the corridor from end to end. From either side of the walkway below, the sudden roar of inmates' voices filled the closed space with howls and bellows of rage.
"What?"
The guard swiveled around, not sure where to look first. They hit him from both sides at once. From where he was positioned overhead, Maul had a perfect view of the carnage below. A wall of bald human inmates burst forward, the Bone Kings barreling down one end of the walkway, while a second mass of bodies, the gravity massive, led by the Nogri Strabo,
came stampeding from the opposite direction to meet their enemies head-on. The guard disappeared between them, immediately trampled underfoot. Maul waited, timing his response to an internal clock whose nuances were a matter of pure reflex. The prisoners were already screaming. In the closed space above, he heard bones snap, the brittle crunch and crackle of cartilage being crushed, bodies flattened underfoot. Now, hanging by his legs, extending both arms just above the battle, Maul thrust both hands down into the fray. He seized the guard by his helmet strap and yanked him upward, using his helmet like a battering ram to smash open the maintenance hatch and shove the man up inside. Alarms began to beep and wail from all sides. Maul scrambled into the utility shaft alongside the guard, his hand locked around the CO's throat.
"Switch those off," he ordered.
"Can't," the guard panted. "It's not..."
Maul pushed the guard back toward the open hatchway.
"Turn them off or I'll throw you down to them. They'll rip you to pieces in a heartbeat."
"I'm telling you, I can't! Alarms have to be deactivated by central control! I swear!"
Maul took hold of the man's right hand, pinning it down on the chain coupling with a hatch cover fit into its housing, and slammed the hatch down on it hard. The guard shrieked, his voice shattering as it reached the upper registers.
"Where's Zero?"
Maul asked softly in his ear.
"I don't know!"
The guard's face had gone terribly pale, except for two bright spots of red high up in his cheeks. Tears of pain stood out in his eyes.
"Nobody knows!"
"How can that be? There are cameras everywhere."
"Not on him. He comes and he goes. Even the guards don't see where or how he gets in and out."
"Then why did the Chatterer fans send me here?"
"I told you. Zero thought you were here to kill him."
"You tell him that I'm looking for him,"
Maul said.
"You tell him I want a real meeting, not a setup."
"He doesn't work that way."
"Where's his cell?"
"It's on level 8, cell 22. Around the far corner. You have to look for it, but it's there. I swear. Now please just let me go."
Maul decoupled the hatch and let it hiss open. The guard groaned, withdrawing his fractured arm with a shuddering whimper, cradling his hand and wrist like a small dead animal dangling limply from his sleeve. Slowly he looked at Maul. Something savage had trickled into his eyes, filling them with rage.
"Inmate 11240,
he said, resting his good hand on the activation stud for the dropbox.
"You're as good as dead, maggot."
Maul studied him.
"We'll see."
The CO hit the button, and nothing happened. Ten. Skin in the game. "You spared him," Vesto Slipher said, careful to keep his tone casual.
"Why?"
Neither of the Blur siblings answered him. From behind the console, Dakari inclined slightly forward in his chair, his right forefinger still pressed tightly to the remote deactivation switch for the guard's dropbox. Siddiqui leaned down over her brother's shoulder for a better view. All five of the screens closest to Dakari's workspace had been redirected to display the maintenance shaft from different angles, providing multiple views of the Zabrak and the guard whose wrist he'd just shattered. Dakari tapped another button, keying in the initiation sequences.
"What's going on?"
Slipher asked.
"Is it?"
All at once, the very air around them took on a low and sonorous hum.
A time code blipped into view in the corners of all the screens, counting down from 5 minutes. Slipher heard a burst of static, and a split second later, a clarion erupted out of the framework of the space station, filling what felt like the entire world with one long, oscillating blast. Dakarai winced. The tremors grew more violent, rhythmic, throbbing like the adrenalized heart of some colossal creature shocked into life. Ripples appeared at the surfaces of his coffee cup, and he reached over to steady it without taking his eyes from the screens.
"What is all this?"
Slipher asked. He'd already surmised exactly what was happening, but he'd long ago discovered the value of asking obvious questions at the right moment. He turned to Siddiqui, speaking loudly to be heard over the alarms.
"What's going on?"
"My brother's algorithm has selected the next two combatants." The warden smiled at one of the monitors. "We're matching them now.
Inmate 11240.
The moon read as the profile appeared on screen.
"That's the Zabrak?"
"Jagannath," Siddiqui said.
"Right.
And that's why..."
She nodded. "We'll only override a guard's authority to activate the electrostatic detonator if the inmate in question is already scheduled for a fight." She nodded at the bank of monitors. "In this case, 11240 has been selected again."
"Who are you pitting him against?"
"Wait and see," Siddiqui said. "I wouldn't want to ruin the surprise."
Slipher glanced around at the other screens, where inmates throughout Coghive 7 were scurrying down the corridors and back to their cells for lockdown. The entire space station was shaking hard enough that he had to brace himself against the wall and wrap his thin, slender fingers around the buttress for support. He could feel the whirring and clicking of Coghive 7's interior clockwork through the floor beneath his feet, reverberating up through his ankles and knees.
"Is it always this loud?"
he shouted.
"It feels like the whole space station is shaking."
"Only about 85% of it."
Siddiqui pointed to the space just above the monitors, where a high-resolution ray tracing of the space station's layout was displaying the reconfiguration in real time. Slipher gazed at the rendering in fascinated silence. Numbers had always been his language of choice, data patterns his poetry. But what was happening here was equally captivating. The ray tracing showed entire wings and cell blocks changing position, pulling themselves around, reformatting the very architecture of the prison itself.
"And here's our new contender," Siddiqui said, pointing at the monitor in front of her.
Slipher looked at what had appeared on the other monitor.
"That's what 11240 is fighting?"
Siddiqui nodded.
"We've never matched it,"
she said. "A couple of freelance bounty hunters brought it in from an abandoned spaceport in the Anoat system, along the Ison trade corridor." She checked the screen. "We think it's been used in previous illegal gladiatorial fights."
"It's called I Know What It Is,"
the moon said. Siddiqui glanced at him, clearly impressed. "You've seen the species before?"
"Not exactly," Slipher told her. "The IBC was briefly involved in arbitrating a former client's involvement in a black market fur trading operation in the Outer Rim. Nothing we were personally involved in, of course, but apparently poachers and big game hunters had been tracking those creatures for decades."
He shook his head.
"Mortality rate among the poachers was often worse than the creatures themselves. You're talking about a predator, 2.5 meters tall, sometimes weighing 200 kilograms or more, with razor-sharp teeth and claws.
They're singularly vicious creatures.
So you don't like the odds? Siddiqui asked.
That thing against the Zabrak?
The moon blinked.
It hardly seems fair.
You haven't seen 11240 in a fight.
Respectfully, Warden, I don't believe that I have to.
We'll see. Siddiqui indicated the overhead consoles, where whole lists of newly formatted data were streaming live through the galaxy. As always, bookmakers and casino bosses have the standard 5-minute window to evaluate the odds. We'll see what they think of the match in the off-world gambling combines. She watched as the displays showed bets, millions of credits pouring in on either side.
Looks like most of them agree with your assessment.
And you?
The moon asked.
How will the esteemed facilitators of Coghive 7 be betting?
We bet what the algorithm tells us.
Always?
Without fail.
And the algorithm is never wrong?
Slipher asked. Siddiqui turned to Dakarai. Her brother tapped in a series of commands and waited for the system to generate its verdict.
You're right, she said. It's going to be no contest.
XI. From the land of the ice and snow.
Maul got back to his cell with seconds to spare. The hatch slammed shut behind him, its mag bolts clamping tight with a vacuum-sealed thump. The panel of yellow lights had begun blinking red. All around him, the cell had already begun changing shape, the floor bowing below his feet, wall plates sliding together with a now familiar grinding of alloy against alloy, constricting upward to merge with the ceiling. He breathed slowly in and out, and took a moment to review what had just happened. None of it made sense. Not that he'd expected it to. The ventilation duct ambush had worked as he'd expected, up to a point. He'd gone in fully anticipating a setup, and in this the guard had not disappointed him. A man like Iram Radik hadn't survived this long without amassing an army of foot soldiers and lookouts, both inmates and guards, to mislead those who came looking for him. Was Zero working for Radik? Could it be that simple? And there was the more immediate question of why he hadn't been killed when the guard had activated the implanted charges in his heart. Had the dark side itself somehow intervened at the last second to save him? The implications of this possibility made Maul catch his breath. For all Darth Sidious's talk of his role as his apprentice and eventual successor, Maul still felt precious little connection to the Sith grand plan for the galaxy and his place within it. At the Dark Lord's command, he'd spent years training on Orsus and then on Coruscant in the Limerage building, enduring years of privation and the harshest imaginable discipline while awaiting his master's visits. And it was true. Sidious had spoken at length, intoxicatingly, about the dark side and its power, and more vaguely about the role Maul would play as he continued in his study of the Sith arts. In his most solitary moments, Maul had dared allowed himself to hope for that moment when the Force would announce itself within him fully, intervening in a way that could not be mistaken for anything but sheer destiny. Could this be that moment? If that's true. There was a sudden lurch, and everything jerked forward on its axis. Maul seized the hand grips on either side of the bench, wedging himself in place, feeling hydrostatic pressure building in his face and neck as the entire chamber turned upside down, then tumbled sideways, pitching first to the left, then to the right.
The cell spun, jerked left, barreled forward, jerked right again. Equilibrium abandoned him momentarily, and he tightened his grip. There was a sharp clank, and the chamber jerked to a halt. Something hissed. A hydraulic hatchway on the other side of one of the walls. But the hatch in front of him remained sealed. Then, through the wall, he heard it. A low, bronchial growl. Maul closed his eyes and listened. Whatever was on the other side of that hatch sounded bigger and hungrier than the creature he'd fought earlier. The growl had a sonorous, barrel-chested timbre that shook the air itself. He caught himself stretching out with his feelings and forced himself to withdraw, his master's voice burning in his ears from their final meeting on Coruscant.
If at any point you reveal your true identity as a Sith Lord,
Sidious had told him,
the entire mission will be worthless. Do you understand? You must not ever use the Force, no matter what the circumstances, or all will be lost. Do you grasp the magnitude of responsibility with which you are being trusted?
Maul did. All too well. He continued to hold absolutely still, listening, attuned to this moment. When the growl came again, it had risen in volume and intensity, and was now a thick snarl of fury. Metal chains clanked, rattling audibly, and something slammed against the wall with a sudden, deafening crash that shook the very bulkhead in front of him. There was another bellow, even louder than before, that he could feel in the hollow of his chest. The thing on the other side of the wall could smell him now. He was sure of it. It wouldn't be long now. The blinking lights went solid red, and the hatch opened. Maul remained motionless for a long moment, looking at it. The Wampa was in chains, bolted to the floor of its cell with heavy nylasteel manacles around its legs, wrists, and throat. It stood almost 3 meters tall, its thick fur matted with filth, grease, and blood. One of its horns had snapped off mid-shaft, creating a jagged, ochre-colored dagger that curled only halfway around the right side of its head. Across its chest and abdomen, great swaths and patches of its white pelt had been ripped away to expose a puckered landscape of scar tissue. No doubt, the results of previous battles. Its lips wrinkled back to reveal rows of razor-sharp teeth, and spittle flew as it unleashed a bellow of hungry, frustrated rage and jerked at its restraints. Maul stood his ground. He gave himself a few seconds to evaluate the space where they would be fighting, the height of the ceiling, the diameter of the chamber, before turning back to stare the thing straight in its yellow, semi-sentient eyes.
Come then.
As if hearing his thoughts, the Wampa leaned down, gathering its strength, and at that moment the manacles fell away. Maul never heard them hit the floor. The thing came at him. Maul leapt upward, dodging the initial attack, but the creature's massive arm swung around as it passed, its claws raking his back, ripping through flesh to gouge deep into the muscle along his spine. Maul felt his breath sucked from his lungs. A cruel, hot spike, even now he refused to think of it as pain, took hold of that entire side of his body, settling deep inside his nerve endings. The sudden smell of his own blood, sharp and coppery, filled the cell. Ducking low and then jumping for the ceiling, he felt hot liquid splashing down his leg, streaking the floor beneath his feet. He skidded, colliding with the wall in front of him. Was the cell actually smaller than it had been a moment ago? Had they already changed the shape of it around him?
Maul took a breath and centered himself. Things were happening too quickly. He needed to slow it down. But the Wampa was already lunging again, its long, ape-like arms swinging, claws carving shadow, smashing him back into the curved steel wall as its jaws snapped inches away from his face. Maul slid down through the pool of his own blood, rolled free, and sprang up behind a thing faster than it could turn. Cocking back one arm, he tensed his shoulder and snapped his elbow into the base of the creature's skull, putting every ounce of upper body strength into a blow that should have shattered its neck. Nothing. It was like launching an elbow strike against solid stone covered with a layer of thick fur. Now the creature rounded on him again, arms upraised, towering to fill what felt like the entire cell. This time when it roared, the noise was more like a scream, a broken, phlegmy, bronchial shriek, as if the beast itself were somehow being tortured into attacking him. A flicker of realization passed through Maul's mind.
Something's wrong with it.
It's not. The Wampa's claw shot forward, slashing diagonally across Maul's face. The moment of clarity vanished in the hot rush of his own anger. Maul lowered his head, tightening up his core, hearing a new growl rising up. His own growl this time, emanating from the most deep and primal pit of his being. He opened himself to it. The deep venom of wrath taking control, fast and sleek and powerful. It would not be long now. Dismissing the bright slash of heat across his cheek and the bridge of his nose, as he had dismissed the odd shimmer of insight that had immediately preceded it, he fell into a low crouch, letting the Wampa come at him again. Its next move would be its last. Maul sprang straight upward into it, driving his horned head into the thing's lower jaw, pulverizing its mandible and slamming needle-sharp bone fragments into its cranial vault. Maul could actually feel the joints and fissures shattering inside the Wampa skull and knew intuitively that he dealt it a killing blow. But when he looked up again, the thing was on its feet and advancing toward him, howling and keening, a blind colossus. The headbutt had left its face a caved-in mass of blood and exposed bone. Somewhere within the cauldron of his anger, Maul felt a wave of disbelief. How was it still fighting? In defiance of all logic, it launched itself at him, all claws and teeth, a mass of unwavering death. Planting his feet against the wall behind him, Maul grabbed the thing by its remaining horn and put every ounce of his strength into twisting its head to the side. He wrenched the thing's head away from him and realized at the last second that he couldn't hold it back. Whatever was inside the Wampa was far more durable than he'd initially expected. The thing lunged again, sinking its teeth into Maul's shoulder, hitting crucial nerve bundles. All the strength disappeared from his hand and wrist, his body turning traitor at the worst possible moment. His arms fell slack and he stumbled backward, staring up at his adversary. Darkness like he'd never known before was swarming through his peripheral vision, thick and pulsating, tightening with every second. For the first time, the impossible occurred to him. The prospect that he might actually lose. He lifted his head, wiped the blood from his eyes.
"Look at it."
A voice spoke from deep inside him. Not the voice of Sidious, but an instinct of self-preservation that far predated his service to his master.
"Do you not see?"
Maul looked. Something was wrong with the Wampa. Something deeply, profoundly wrong that went beyond genetically predisposed violence and a history of predatory killing. And just that quickly, he knew how to end it. Summoning whatever remained of his strength, Maul fired himself at the beast. Hooking his hands into claws,
He plunged them through its fur, ripping into the soft tissue of its torso. The Wampa screeched and wailed. Maul barely heard it. Shoving his hands deeper, he sank both arms in, up to the elbow, beneath its ribcage, and into its thoracic cavity, groping until he found what he was looking for. The slick, pulsating mass of its heart. Maul grabbed it, laced his fingers together, and squeezed. The Wampa's heart burst between his fingers like a dense and fibrous flower. At once the thing tumbled backward with a kind of graceless shambling sprawl, slumping against the wall with a low moan, as if released from bondage beyond any chains or shackles. It gave a final braying cough, shuddered once, and fell still. Maul licked the blood from his teeth and spat. He stumbled back, tried to catch himself, and failed. Fatigue was already taking hold. A dense and miserable web that made the simplest motions difficult. The blood he'd lost was not so easily countered. The darkness was coming again. And this time, he knew that he wouldn't be able to hold it off. The last thing he saw was the cell around him shifting and beginning to rise. Then, blackness. FaceTime. The Twi'lek known as Zero stepped around the corner and into the mess hall. He emerged as he always did, without fanfare, always within a crowd of inmates large enough to mask his point of entry. As far as appearances went, his was a model of absolute subtlety. One moment he wasn't there, the next he was. All around him, the hall was already getting busy. The dinner hour had just begun. Falling silently into line behind two prisoners who'd just picked up their trays, he edged closer to them. "Any news?" At the sound of his voice, the other two inmates turned and glanced back at him with a squint of recognition.
"Hey, Z,"
one of them said, his mouth twisting into a gap-toothed grimace.
"Where you been keeping yourself?"
"Here and there," the Twi'lek answered vaguely. "Who's asking?"
"Just curious is all. We were all wondering what happened to you when that bomb went off."
The Twi'lek frowned and shook his head.
"That was no bomb."
"No?"
"The kitchen staff found a pressure cooker full of chemicals lodged inside the dishwasher."
He glanced at the line of inmates waiting to be served their evening meal.
"Guess we'll all be eating off dirty trays for a while."
The second inmate blinked, processing the information.
"Somebody sending a message. Creating a diversion, like."
"I don't think so."
"What then?"
Zero didn't answer, scanning the room in front of him. The inmate to his right, a convicted smuggler and three-time loser named Miggs, gave a shrug.
"Yeah, well, what are you gonna do, am I right?"
With a distracted nod, Zero stepped forward. They carried their trays into the serving line, bypassing a half-dozen members of the Gravity Massive, their faces bruised and swollen. At least one of them was still actively bleeding through his makeshift bandages.
"You hear what happened to them?"
Miggs asked.
"Run in with the Bone Kings," Zero said. "Word is they hashed it out in the tunnels last night before the bout."
"Figures."
Miggs held up his tray so that the service droid on the other side of the counter could slop a ladle of colorless protein gel into it.
"Ugh. This stuff smells even worse than usual."
Behind him, Zero raised his own tray. With a click of recognition, the kitchen droid paused and then turned to lift the lid on a different serving tureen.
extending tongs from its manipulators to serve Zero a steaming portion of succulent-smelling meat and fresh vegetables.
Chaladon steak, medium rare, with Remorian caponata and a side of fresh soufar greens,
it announced. Thank you. Zero nodded and took the tray, carrying it forward while the droid went back to the vat of gray, semi-liquefied gel for the next convict in line.
You see that fight, by the way? He asked.
You kidding?
Miggs glanced at the con who had followed them into the main dining area, to their usual table at the far end of the room.
Halleck and I clocked the whole thing on Hollow from the gallery. Watched it like 8 times already, right?
Sitting down, the inmate behind him, Halleck, bobbed his head up and down.
Squall of a thing, too. You should have clocked on it, Zero. For real.
Is that so?
The Twi'lek cut off a thin slice of steak and sniffed it before putting it into his mouth. What happened?
That red-skinned freak, the one they call the Tooth. What's his name? Jagannath.
Miggs shoveled in a bite of his own food and gulped it down, wiping the corner of his mouth with his shirt cuff.
They put him in there again. And the powers that be or whatever, they match him up against this crazy snow beast.
A wampa?
The Twi'lek cocked an eyebrow.
I wasn't aware that they actually still have one of them here.
Had one.
Miggs said grimly, picking up his fork again.
So anyway, it starts out pretty much exactly like you'd expect. This wampa's just pounding the unholy guts out of old Redskin, really making him work for his dinner, right? I mean, it's not even fair. We're all thinking Mr. Tooth is going to lose a lot more than his tooth this time, you know what I'm saying?
Another bite loaded in, chewed twice, and swallowed.
Then all of a sudden, just when you think it's over, bam!
Miggs slammed his fist on the table and paused for dramatic effect.
The Tooth, like, actually reaches in and tears open the thing's chest.
Is that so?
And then he shoves his hand into the thing's stomach up to his elbows, grabs the thing's heart, and, like, crushes it in his bare hands.
Zero took another bite of steak.
Impressive.
I'm not even yanking you, man. They showed the whole thing. And then, boom, the wampa just kind of sags back and dies on the spot.
Miggs shook his head again.
Totally non-linear. Makes you think, though.
Zero stopped chewing. Does it?
Yeah, I mean.
Miggs picked up his fork, nudged his food around the tray, and put it down again.
'Cause, I mean, when you cogitate on it, if they've got a wampa in here, then seriously, who knows what else they got locked up downside, you know?
Such as?
Well, I mean, like, the wolfworm.
Zero gazed at him opaquely.
You really believe that?
Dunno, man. I heard rumors is all. Way down inside the prison, where nobody ever goes.
The Twi'lek was about to comment when he felt something bump against him hard enough to knock his tray sideways. He turned around and saw the inmates standing directly behind him. Bone Kings. 4 of them. Zero studied their faces, one by one.
Nice meal, Zero,
the bald, bearded inmate in front said, drawing the name out with deliberate sing-song mockery while he eyed the half-finished steak and greens on Zero's plate.
You know, there's something I've always been meaning to ask you. How come you always get to eat better than the rest of us?
I would think that would be abundantly obvious, Zero said. I walk a higher path than you do.
Is that so?
In almost every conceivable regard, Zero said. Yes.
A silence fell between them.
He recognized the man in front of him as Vass Nailhead, boss of the kings. Nailhead was a flesh-eater, known among the gladiatorial fighting circuit for devouring at least some part of every living thing he'd ever killed. Word was that he enjoyed a cult following, and was one of the few inmates to receive fan mail, packages, even the occasional wedding proposal. Although rumors circulated that he actually had a family and relatives back on Tepassi.
Funny thing is...
Nailhead leered at him. Spit bubbles clustered at the corners of his lips. He was literally foaming at the mouth. From inside the left sleeve of his uniform, a long, hard shape protruded against the fabric. Its sharpened tip just visible at the end of his sleeve.
I bet your blood comes spilling out just as easily as anybody else's here. What do you think?
On either side of him, in his peripheral vision, Zero saw Miggs and Halleck rising gamely to their feet into a protective stance. He gestured for them to sit down. It's all right, he said quietly. I'm sure that Mr. Nailhead was just getting ready to apologize for his unseemly behavior.
Wrong again, Zero.
Without waiting for an answer, Nailhead reached down and grabbed Zero's collar, yanking him to his feet so abruptly that the Twilix tray flipped over and went cluttering to the floor, spilling the remains of a steak and greens across the tiles beneath their feet. The sharpened shaft of bone in Nailhead's sleeve had edged up so and was now pushing into the soft place beneath Zero's neck.
See, we learned something new last night when we faced off against the gravity massive in the tunnels,
Nailhead said.
Us and them. Worked it out together, you might say.
Oh?
The Twilix's gaze remained absolutely steady.
And what might that be?
We don't need you. Nearly as much as you need us. Fact is, the only reason you run the place like this is because these maggots think you do. Once they stop thinking it, you stop running it.
Fascinating, Zero said. It's a miracle that none of you was hurt, thinking so hard.
Nailhead grunted.
Not half as fascinating as it's gonna be when we haul you off to the tunnels and rip out your throat.
Is that what Delia would want?
Nailhead stiffened. He pushed the sharpened bone slightly deeper into the soft tissue of Zero's throat, fixing him with a stare.
What did you just say?
Your sister, the Twilix answered. She still sends you letters, doesn't she? Because she thinks about you. She remembers what life used to be like on Tepassi. After everything you've done, she hasn't stopped hoping you'll come back and be the boy that she remembers. The one who could always sing and make her laugh with every verse of Sweet Frond of Fame. Nailhead drew in a shallow, audible breath and cocked his head ever so slightly. Behind the rumpled tangle of his beard, all the ferocity had drained from his expression, leaving his face strangely slack and vacant.
How did you?
He swallowed and continued, his voice oddly hoarse.
How did you know about that?
I've been here a long time, Zero said. You learn all sorts of things when you've been here as long as I have. A person of interest such as myself hears things about your family and your sister in particular. And, of course, I can always pass on messages in either direction.
Nailhead released him and took a step back. For an instant, a spark of what could have been actual civility shimmered in the cloudy depths of his eyes.
a distant clarity that reflected back on the man he might have been beneath years of suffocating depravity. Perhaps it's time you returned to your friends, Mr. Nailhead. Zero spoke in the same gentle, patient tone with which he might suggest an evening stroll through the common area. It sounds as if you still have some thinking to do. Nailhead took another step away, his hands hanging limp at his sides. He said nothing, didn't even blink, just turned and began making his way back across the dining hall to where the other Bone Kings were waiting.
Whoa!
Miggs exhaled as he and Halleck watched Nailhead depart.
Zero, man, that was crazy, even for you. How did you...
He looked back at the table and stopped. Zero was already gone. XIII. Cautionary Tale. Maul was waiting just inside the cell when the Twi'lek came back from the mess hall, hiding in the shadows to the right of the hatchway. At the sound of approaching footsteps, he stepped into view. For a moment, Zero just stared at him. To his credit, he didn't bother trying to run. He didn't even look particularly surprised. "Jagannath," he said, "you're looking surprisingly well, all things considered." Maul said nothing. In the 12 hours since his last fight, he'd recovered almost completely from the wounds that the Wampa had inflicted on him. His face still bore the blood-encrusted slash marks from its claws, but he'd regained full use of his arm, and his strength actually seemed to have intensified in response to the attack, like an organism that had thrived from being pruned down close to the taproot. "You know," Zero said, "I was wondering when we'd get a chance to meet."
"You didn't make it easy,"
Maul said,
"sending that guard to come after me in the tunnels."
"Well, of course, someone like me can't afford to cast too long a shadow. I'm sure you understand." "In any case," Zero said, giving Maul a small smile, "you didn't seem to have any trouble handling yourself."
"I expected a setup,"
Maul said. "In which case, I'm glad that I didn't disappoint you. To what do I owe the pleasure?"
"I need something."
A refreshing lack of pretense. The Twi'lek smiled again. "Please sit down, make yourself comfortable. Can I get you anything?" Maul remained standing, allowing his silence to answer for him. In the hour that he'd spent waiting inside the cell, anticipating Zero's return, he'd searched it thoroughly. The investigation had proven highly fruitful. Although outwardly similar to every other cell in Coghive 7, Zero's quarters had been customized with 1,000 subtle luxuries that might escape casual observation. Beneath the bunk, he'd discovered a small library, a secret storage chamber stocked with a private supply of food, drink, and utensils, and whole caches of electronic components in various states of assembly. "Something to eat, perhaps?" Zero asked, reaching under the bed to pull out a narrow cabinet of prepared meals. "My own dinner was somewhat rudely interrupted, so I hope you'll forgive me if..."
"I want Iram Radik."
Zero stopped what he was doing and looked up, his expression unreadable. "I beg your pardon?"
"I know he's here. I seek an audience with him privately, as soon as possible. And you seem to be the one who can arrange such a thing."
The Twi'lek said nothing. Maul stood riveted to his gaze.
"You must be relentless,"
Sidious had told him.
Use every means at your disposal to gather information. We have an extremely finite amount of time in which to arrange for the purchase of the nuclear device from Radik and its delivery into the hands of the Bando Gora. But throughout it all, you must keep in mind that in Coghive 7, the name of Iran Radik will always be spoken with dread.
In this case, however, Zero surprised him. He looked at Maul blankly for a moment, his lips tightening, then twitching, and then burst out laughing. A spontaneous bray of amusement that seemed, for the moment at least, to cost him every ounce of his composure.
Oh, I must apologize, the Twi'lek managed when he finally appeared to pull himself together. You see, it's just... Oh, my.
Attempting to catch his breath, he wiped the tears from his eyes and looked up at Maul.
Iram Radik, you say? You don't ask much, do you?
With another chuckle, he shook his head.
Tell me, is there anything else I can get for you in the meantime? Your own private starfighter, perhaps? An audience with the Galactic Senate? The Lost Moons of Yavin?
Maul just stared at him, expressionless.
Oh, forgive me, Zero said. It's not your fault. I can see that you've been misinformed about the scope of my abilities here. If you are looking to have a certain type of food smuggled in, or a more comfortable uniform, or even a particular pet, then yes, perhaps I could be of assistance. But
I want Radik, Maul said. I know he's here. And if anyone can find him, it's you.
But Twi'lek had settled himself completely now and stopped laughing. He lowered his weight down in his bunk, gazing up at Maul with his meal unopened on his lap.
Let me tell you a story, he said, if you'll indulge me.
Without waiting for Maul's reply, Zero peeled back the synthetic wrap that covered some kind of glazed-looking reddish-pink fruit dish, waved it momentarily beneath his nose, and took a small nibble.